I've talked often enough to audiences about days in the music hall and people I work with, but I've never actually talked before about being a dancer in the Variety Theatre. So what I would like to say is, if anybody wants to ask any questions throughout the lecture, don't wait until I speak and throw it up. If you want to ask any questions throughout the lecture, providing you give me, you know, you come into the right pause, then I'll be very happy. I think it might make it more interesting. At the end of the talking, I have a picture, a film of the five Sherry brothers to show you. This is the act I was with, of course, for the best part of 10 years before the war. And sadly, we never got together again after the war. That's the last war I'm talking about, not the first one, although I was also around when that was going on. But right, are we all okay? You've got your... Splendid, we've got the tape recorders going, so do come in. Right, I'm going to start off now. The title being A Dancer in the Variety Theatre. Well, I come from a music hall family. A family of 11. And I was the youngest of 9 children. I was born to my parents, James Bernard Sherry and Alice Louise Sherry, on January the 12th, 1912. I don't do any arithmetic about finding out how old I am. My father had been a music hall artist, a music hall performer, in the 80s and 90s of the last century. And my mother's parents had been performers in the 1850s in both the theatre and the music hall. So my roots go quite deep in the entertainment profession. Sadly to say, I'm the last member of the family. There is nobody else coming along. No other members of the younger members of my family, not my family, I have no children of my own, but have shown any great interest in being a professional entertainer. They've all gone into 9-to-5 jobs or something like that. My father, of course, was an entertainer during the heyday of the music halls, when they were growing rapidly in as a popular entertainer for the working class, because that's the only entertainment there was in those days. And of course, they were developing into the variety theatres from the music halls, which were part of the old pub setup, very much like folk clubs of today. The ones that did extremely well built small theatres at the back of the pubs, and then of course bigger and bigger theatres were built, and so the music hall became the entertainment not only of the lower classes, of the working classes, but also of the middle and upper classes, as the acts were cleaned up and presented in properly built theatres. And so theatres were built from about 1870 until 1914, the start of the First World War. Theatres were built in every town of any size in Britain. Mostly two theatres, one music hall and one what they call legitimate theatre, which was for plays and proper actors. During this time, of course, my father was a performer. He was very successful. He went under the name of Dan Conroy. He didn't use his proper name of James Bernard Sherry. I never know why, actually, but he was called Dan Conroy. He had a lot of success. He travelled the world with trips to Australia, South Africa, New Zealand. That was in the days, you know, in the early 1900s or the late 1890s, when those places were still very rough and tough places to go to. He worked out in Kalgoorlie, in the goldfields of Australia. And I remember seeing when I was a youngster a couple of gold nuggets which he'd brought back from Australia or South Africa. I don't know what became of those nuggets. They're not around now. Mother's parents, as I say, were performers in the 1850s and from onwards. And they did dramatic sketches. They went under the name of Harry Bradley and Miss Laura Truman. Mr. Harry Bradley and Miss Laura Truman, which is, of course, how everybody was called in those days. I have a bill at home of my father in Australia, Mr. Dan Conroy. So it's Mr. Sam Sherry, if you please. I've written this down. I can't read it. I haven't got my glasses on. My father was a contemporary of the great clog dancers of that era, Dan Leno, who was the world champion, who won the world championship in Leeds in around about 1897, I think. I think he lost it the next year, and then he won it back in Oldham, dancing six nights against all comers, and there were a lot of comers in those days, to retain the championship, and he won the belt for three times, and the gold belt is still in the Leno family. And I have seen a picture of it, but I haven't actually seen the belt. So my father was, as I say, a contemporary of Dan Leno, and also of a man called Jimmy Haslam, who my dad said was the best dancer he ever saw. He said he was even better than Leno, but then we all have our preferences, don't we? Other great dancers of that era. My my mother's people bought a pub in Bolton. It was called the Old Man and Scythe, and they paid £100 for it, which they'd saved out of their earnings in show business. Imagine buying a pub in the middle of Bolton for £100. It's great. I wish I could buy a pub in the middle of Bolton for £100. I'd be there today. I've lost my thread now. Father passed on his dancing skills to his family. Everybody, even boys and girls, were taught to turn the toe, which was the name given to the round shuffle, which you all know I don't, and I fall over now, you know, I can't help it. That turning the toe, and we were taught that to do that almost as soon as we could walk. The first steps I remember doing, the first step I ever remember learning, was the walking shuffle, which is this one. Which I now incorporate in some of my waltz routines. That was the first step I ever learned, as far as I can remember. This, you know, it's going a long way back now. I also learned from my father what he called the first three Lancashire steps. And two of those are ones which we've seen a lot done today. Everybody, I think, who's danced today has done that Lancashire step, the hop lanks, which you all probably know, with the possible exception of our friend the American, who did something very much like it anyway, and that's this one. Hop lank step, that's the one, and the other one was the first lanks, which was... That's the first lanks. There's also a second lanks, which isn't done so very often, although a lot of my pupils do it, and that's this one. Those three steps go back at least 100 years, so you can say they're antiques. So you are learning something traditional and doing something very traditional when you do those steps. My brother Peter, who was 15 months my senior, left school at 14 and went to join my elder brothers, who were doing an act called Dan Brothers and Sherry at that time, and he continued his training with them. We had, of course, all during our school days, had to practice every night. Every day when we came home from school, we weren't allowed to go out to play until we'd done some dancing and acrobatic practice. We practiced on the tile floor of our kitchen, and that was a hard place to learn acrobatics. We did have a rag rug on the floor, which, if you fell during an acrobatic trick, didn't save very much for you for the bruises and that you used to get. So we learned very quickly, because it was hard. And the quicker you learn, the less you hurt yourself. As I say, my brother Peter then went on to travel with my elder brothers. And when I left school, also at 14, I joined them as well to continue my training. We spent about 12 months, this would be in 1926, early 27, learning routines from my brother Jim, who was a very, very fine dancer, and who had mixed with good dancers all over Europe and Britain since his younger days, and was a great dancer in every respect. He was taught to wing by Harry Scott, the famous actor Scott and Whaley, who you might know the name. They were a colored American actor who came over just after the First World War and had a great lengthy run of popularity in England. As a matter of fact, I think they stayed in England until they retired. So we learned from Jim, who was a great dancer and a great teacher. The teaching methods which I employ today, I learned from Jim, which was his ability to break down the step, which made him such a good teacher, to take a step to pieces. And I think that's had a great influence on clogging over the past 15 years since I came on the scene, in the folk scene, that this has now become the general style of teaching, to break a step right down and take it into bits so that people can learn it easily. This wasn't so in my young days. Apart from my brother Jim, if somebody else showed you a step, they would show you the step and you had to pick it up. If you didn't get it, well, you lost it. That's all there was to it. Peter and I, when we had got an act together, after about 12 months, both doing acrobatic tricks, step dancing and learning to wing. And winging, of course, I don't know whether any of you know, of course, it's definitely not a clog step, but that's winging actually, but of course with the legs in the air doing something entirely different. So that, can't do it anymore, so nobody's really trying to demonstrate it. But that's winging, which was of course an American invention by the American tap dancers. But it became the norm over here to try to learn to wing. Peter and I joined a show called This Is It. In those days, most of the music halls or the variety theatres had what they called touring revues. These were generally a vehicle for a comedian who would work right through the show in various scenes and would be supported by a feed, a character man, or sometimes a soubrette, a troupe of girls, and perhaps one or two speciality acts, like speciality dancing acts. Dan Brothers and Sherry were at that time appearing in a show called Contrasts, and this was based on the comedy man burlesquing each straight item that had gone before. For instance, they would perhaps sing Sometimes Between, and he'd come on and sing Sometimes Between Long Drinks and Bottle Bass. You know, the others were Sometimes Between Long Shadows on the Grass, that's right. And that was the sort of thing. Everything throughout the show was a contrast to the one that had gone before, or a burlesque on it. The comic in that show was a man called Tom Moss, who came from Wigan, was known as the Wigan Whippet. He was a vocal comedian, a man with a very good voice, and so apart from his comedy, he could also take off the singers, in a funny way, with a very good voice. Tom lived to the ripe old age of 84, and I saw him only a few years ago. Lived in Preston, and he came to one of my dancing classes in Preston about 5 years ago. Sadly, he has since died. As I say, Peter and I were booked into a show called This Is It. But I go back to Contrast now. There was in that show, apart from my brothers who danced, there was a double dancing act called The Two Carrs. These were Scottish lads, Jimmy and Peter Carr, who one small and tubby, the other tall and thin. But they had a very nice, easy style of dancing and were very, very successful. The last week that we were with my elder brothers in the show Contrast was at the Tivoli Aberdeen. And on the Friday night, the Two Carrs very, very kindly gave up one of their dancing spots so that Peter and I could try our act out. And so that would be in, I think, in February 1928. And so you can say that it's quite a long time ago. We then went to join This Is It, which starred a comedian called Noor Kiddie, who probably none of you have ever heard of, but he was a very funny man who based his comedy on the great Harry Weldon, who probably none of you have heard of anyway, unless you're students of music hall. Harry Weldon was a very famous comedian and his most famous act was called Stiffy the Goalkeeper, and it was more or less a mime act where he used to be in playing a goalkeeper and all the various things he did. You know, the ball was going in various directions and that sort of thing. He was a great, great success with Harry Weldon for many, many years. We toured with This Is It for about 7 months, and then I was taken ill and had to leave for a while. And my brother Peter carried on, but then he left, came back home to join me. We lived in Nottingham in those days. We weren't Lancashire people. We were actually born and brought up in Nottingham, where my grandparents had a pub. They'd left the manor side in Bolton and gone to a little village in Nottingham called Costock, and they'd bought the Red Lion pub there. That's where my father met my mother, and that's where the whole of the Shelley family, nine of us, were born. Where?
In
Eastleigh. Do you?
I didn't know you were
Well, fancy that then. Yeah, I know the Red Lion's still there, but the house I was born in isn't there.
Oh.
That was on what is now the Red Lion car park. So there won't be a plaque on there saying Oh, well. Now, where have we got to? Oh, yes. Going back to my first week away from home, when I was 14, it was actually at Bolton, of all places, and the Grand Theatre, which was just a few doors from the Manorside pub, which my grandparents had owned many years before. The Manorside is still there. It's a showpiece of an old-fashioned pub. It's a listed building preserved for posterity. So if you're in Bolton, go and have a half a pint in the Manorside and say, well, Sam Shelley's mother once lived here, and his grandparents. That was actually in the heart of what was called Bolton Theatre Land in those days. There were three theatres there. There was the Grand, the Theatre Royal and the Hippodrome. My first week away at Bolton, at the Grand, with my older brothers, and I shall never forget my first week in Diggs. Of course, Diggs were a great thing in Crowe's life. They either made your life great or they made it a misery. These were run by Mrs. Seddon, Fanny Seddon, and her husband was a policeman in Bolton, and I shall never forget how kind she was, her very slow, soft Lancashire accent. And I can also remember waking up on the Monday morning to the clatter of clogs along the street outside as the Lancashire lasses went to work in the mill in the clogs and shawls. That was, of course, in 1927, when King Cotton still ruled. You'd have a job to find any clatter of clogs in Lancashire anymore, I'm afraid, apart from the clog dancers. Going back then to the end of our touring with This Is It, we then went into the family show, a family show called The Sherry Cocktail. My elder brothers put on this show, which was actually Contrast, which they bought from the people who were putting on a new show. They bought all the scenery and the props of Contrast and put it on as a sherry cocktail. This included eight of our family, my eldest brothers, Dan, Harry and Jim, and my sisters, Alice Louise, who was known to us as Lally, who, by the way, is 83 years old tomorrow, and my sister Louisa and my sister Bess, and the other sister, Day, wasn't in that particular show. So there were eight out of the nine of the family in that show, The Sherry Cocktail. We toured with great success around the country. I remember our first week was at the Palace Theatre of Bath, and we toured with great success about the country for quite a long time, until the advent of the talkies. Now, if you think back, you probably never remember what it was like to see silent films. Of course, my young days, there were only silent films. So when the talkies came out, there were a world-beating sensation. You know, to hear people talk on the screen was something entirely we'd never imagined before. And so it changed show business completely. The variety theatres, which had actually flourished then, along with the silent pictures, because it wasn't really opposition, it was something that went along with it. But when the talking pictures came, that altered show business completely. and many, many theatres turned over to talking pictures. So they did alter things completely. So we, as a Sherry family, we then went into a show for the late George Black called Paddington Parade, which was unfortunately not a success. It was what they call in show business terms a turkey. And it died after about 6 weeks. We then formed the Five Sherry Brothers Act, and this would be about 1930, in the 30 or 31. And this was a great success right from the very start. This is the one that I'm going to show you later on, or parts of it, not all of it by any means. And we then toured in this show for 8-9 years. We played all the variety theatres there were to play, I think, in Britain. There was still plenty of work to be had. There must have been, I think there was still somewhere in the region of 600 or 700 variety theatres even then. Every town, mostly every town of any size, kept a variety theatre. Some of them, the smaller towns, went over to talking pictures. But in the main, there was still plenty of work to be had. It was then that I came, this is where I come to the subject of my lecture, Dancer on the Variety Theatre. This is where I met other dancers, the first time really. Previous to that, I had, as I've told you about the two cars, and also in that show there were chorus girls who were good step dancers and who used to join us occasionally for practice. But until we joined the Five Sherry Brothers Act and started in variety proper, rather than being in a family show or a review, because the review by that time was starting to die out and variety was coming back in. So for the first time, I came across other dancers and exchanged steps, got new ideas, and this was a real broadening of my experience as a dancer. I still mainly, depended upon my brother Jim, who was a great innovator and a great maker up of steps, and we practiced virtually every day. Well, not every day, but you'd get to a theatre on a Sunday by train. The baggage man, that was the man that looked after your luggage, would meet you with a horse and cart, very likely, or possibly a wagon. He would load all your theatrical props onto it and take it down to the theatre. You would go to your digs, very often digs which you had fixed weeks and weeks ahead, because you knew, as soon as you got a booking, you say, this is so-and-so's digs, or we must write in. So the best digs, of course, were always booked up before you got into town. I have on many occasions, of course, got to town without any digs and spent a wet Sunday night walking around streets, knocking at doors. Have you got any digs? But you always remember the good part, you don't remember the bad one, do you? So coming back to the variety theatre and the dancers, I then met many other dancers, and of course at that time the talking pictures had brought in the all-singing, all-dancing epics. The Broadway melodies of 1932, 3, 4, and all the great musicals of that time, and of course it was a fantastic time for dancing. And this is when the actual American tap sort of took over, and the old clog walloping was virtually forgotten. And there were very few pockets of resistance left to this invasion of American tap. But there were a few in the northeast, in the northwest, in East Anglia, as you see, with Dick Louis, in the West Country and in Wales, where there was a Welsh style of clog dancing, of course, which did survive, mainly because the Welsh are very cultural conscious, and so they kept it going. But tap swept the world, actually, and the time step became the thing to do. Now, a time step was a fairly simple step. This is it. You can do it twice, you can do it on that single leg. Do it double leg. So you can vary it in all sorts of ways, and you've got the spectacle on the films of perhaps 100 chorus girls, all very lovely, in scanty dresses, doing a time step. It's so it went on. And dancing teachers in this country latched on to this time step, and they taught it, some well, some very badly. And the whole of the dancing world became time step conscious. And so all you got was the time step, you got nothing else. And so this was the time of the decline of the British style of dancing. Everybody went on to tap. You got fabulous dancers such as Fred Astaire with his various partners, Ginger Rogers and others. You got people like Buddy Ebsen, Dan Daly, Stephen Fetchit. Well, I'm all written down here. I don't look at it, do I? Buck and Bubbles. These were, then were followed on by such people as Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, and the great dancers that followed on. And of course this carried on right until the Second World War in 1939. By that time, everything was tap. You seldom, if ever, saw anybody in a pair of clogs. The only person I can remember who did a clog dance was a little Yorkshire comic, whose name escapes me at the moment. It's come to me there. Walter Niblow, that was it. And Walter always used to finish up his act, having done his comedy pattern, Walter, he always used to finish up with a little clog dance at the end. It was a novelty, of course, because nobody else was doing it. But he was the only man I think I ever saw do any clog dancing during the, what I call the tap era, when everybody was tap mad, and there were usually one or two dancing acts on every variety bill that were tapping away, one form or another, time steps and more time steps. And, excuse me. And so, I met, as I said, a lot of other dancers who were in the old tradition, and I learned quite a lot of steps from them. There was an act called Hal Mack and his Dancing Demons. This was an old style troupe of about a dozen youngsters who were trained by Hal Mack, and they did every style of dance you could think of, every tempo. And they were called a farm act in those days. If you were a dancer and you want a young dancer and you wanted to get on the stage and you had no other means of entry, then you could join Hal Mack and his Dancing Demons. You'd get about $5 to spend a week, and you'd get your keep, and you'd learn to dance. And a lot of dancers, you know, did learn their trade that way. And of course, once they become good dancers, they then branched out either single acts or went into other acts and so carried on like that. Another act that I remember very well was G.S. Melvin, who was a character comedian. And G.S. Melvin used to do, one of his comedy characters was a stoker, a naval stoker. And he used to finish up his act with a marvellous sailor's hornpipe dance. It was really wonderful. He was so light and like a feather on his feet. It was great. Another wonderful dancer of that time was a man called Victor Andre. And Victor did mostly character dances. He would do with changes of costume. He'd open up after the military dance as an old-fashioned military costume, then go into a naval and do a sailor's hornpipe and so on and so forth. And he travelled extensively, both on the continent and in Britain. There was also, I'll talk to you about G.S. Melvin, haven't I? And I spent a lot of time with a Glasgow comedian called A.J. Powers, Andy Powers. Andy taught me the pickup, which of course is that. That's the pickup. And he also taught me the step which I now teach as the A.J. Powers step, which is that one. Which a lot of my pupils, some of my pupils do, they wanted to be with me a fair length of time, and I call that the A.J. Powers step, and I'm very happy to, you know, to do so, because Andy was such a great man as a teacher and a wonderful fellow to be with. So then we come to about 1939 and the war. We were doing extremely well, the Five Sherry Brothers, playing all the best theatres in the land. Made one or two small, short films for fluffy pictorial, one of which you will see later on. And of course, along came the war. We were at the time playing at the Pavilion Theatre in Glasgow in a show called Clarity at 8:30. Clarity was the saying of a very famous Scottish comedian of that time called Tommy Morgan. He used to say Clarity. I never knew what he meant, but everybody used to, the house used to fall apart with laughter when he said Clarity, Clarity. So it must have some, you know, meaning which is lost on a Saturnac. Any Scots folk here? Can they tell us? No? Oh well. So the war came along, and of course, the younger of us were due for military service. I was called up into the Royal Tank Corps in 1940, just before Christmas. It was a lovely Christmas present. And then, not long after, my brother Peter went into the RAF. So that was the end of the five Sherry brothers. The elder brothers, of course, who had been soldiers in the First World War, they were too old for military service, so they carried on in entertainment. My brother Harry, who didn't have good health, he left the business and took a pub in Rochdale. And that's a fate worse than death. No, it's not. I like Rochdale. And my brother Dan and Jim went into comedy and more or less gave up the dancing. Jim gave up the dancing and they just concentrated on comedy. So when eventually, after 5.5 years in the army, during which time I did a great deal of entertaining, although I was still an active service soldier, I had my guitar with me and I used to sing and play and dance and do acrobatics in camp concerts and all over the place in both Britain and North Africa. And then when I came back in 1946 and was demobbed, Peter had been demobbed from the RAF shortly before, and we both got together and started practicing again to put on a song and dance and acrobatic act. We were booked for the summer season at the Wellington Pier, Great Yarmouth, for a man called Will Catlin, who had started his career almost as early as my father, or even earlier, with a Piero troupe on the Sands at either Bridlington or Fylde, one of those places. And he had then gone on to become a theatre owner, a producer of shows. And Will Catlin's Follies were very well known in many, many of the seaside towns of Britain. So we did a season, Peter and I, at the Great Yarmouth Wellington Pier, with our, still doing our double dancing act, acrobatics, also being a feed for the comic and playing any parts which came up, which you had to do, of course. And we stayed with Catlin's for about, we did three seasons, I think, for Catlin's. And then we went to the North Pier at Blackpool for On With The Show, and the star of which was Albert Modley, the famous Yorkshire comedian of the day. And we carried on then, Peter and I, for quite a long time. Did about 8 or 9 years of good work. But actually the business of variety was shrinking. With the advent of television after the war, probably you can't envisage a world without television, but before the war there was no Palace. The five Sherry brothers did a show called Café Continental from Alexandra Palace in the early days of television. That was in 1937 or 8, I think. And a young compere of that Café Continental was a man called Cyril Fletcher, who was doing his odd odes then. He's still doing them now, all those years later. So he did very well out of his odd odds and still. That's, by the way, come back to the fact that the music hall or the variety theatre was shrinking, mainly due to the competition of home entertainment. When you could sit at home, just turn the knob and watch something, whether it was good, bad or indifferent. If the night wasn't nice, you wouldn't go out. So gradually the theatres were closing. So we actually got, we did very well. We got good long summer season runs, good long pantomime runs, so we fiddled variety days in between. But the interest in tap dancing had waned. There were still plenty of dancing acts on the halls, but the actual interest had waned. And the advent of television, which didn't seem as if it could actually show dancing except very simple movements. I mean, they had fixed cameras in those days. It wasn't like it is today where they follow you everywhere and pan in and pan out or along or whatever they do today. It's all beyond my comprehension now what they can do. They could even put you in the air and bring you down again without you moving. But so the interest in tap dancing or in step dancing waned, and gradually, you know, it seemed as if it was there wasn't much of a future in it. So eventually, Peter and I decided to call it a day. How are we going off the time, by the way? And the last 2 weeks we played were the Theatre of Hanley and the Hippodrome Dudley, the new Hippodrome in Dudley. And Hilda Baker, who had made a big name on television after donkey's years going around the small theatres, she was top of the bill. And it's interesting that on the same bill, now last week, was a double Scotch dancing duo called the McKinnon Sisters. So we'd started with the two cars in 1928, Scottish dancing duo. We finished with the McKinnon Sisters, 1956. All those years later, also a Scottish double dancing act. I'll have to refer to him now, so I'm trying to do it all from memory. I shouldn't do, should I? Oh, the last 2 weeks, I've talked about the last 2 weeks. Hilda Baker was, and the McKinnon Sisters. And interestingly enough, Hilda Baker herself had been a clog dancer in her younger days, although I never saw her do any steps. But she did say she'd been a clog dancer. Thinking back over the years has brought many other names to mind. It's amazing once your brain starts ticking over what does come back to you. There was a very famous dancing family called the Ascot family when I first started. Dougie Ascot was their prime dancer, and a very fine dancer he was. A coloured gentleman, and I say gentleman meaning it, called Fred Brand. He didn't get the name right, did he? Fred Brand, who was a great dancer, and the man who used to specialise in jumping over his legs, you know that one. And he used to jump over it up there. Fantastic, he used to go and over the top and back the other way and over the top that way. He was amazing, actually, with Fred. A great character to be with. Scott Riley, who I've already told you about, who taught my brother Jim to wing. And a host of others, you know, whose names escape me now. But it's amazing how many people, when you look back over, you've met and been with. Of course, another man who comes to mind is Max Wall. Now, Max is mainly famous for his eccentric dancing, but he was a top-flight tap and step dancer. He was a great dancer. And to end my story, recently I had the pleasure of sharing a dressing room with Max when I unexpectedly got a job at the Old Vic Theatre in London in John Arden's famous, almost classic play, Sergeant Musgrave's Dance, which is set in the North Country and has clog dancing as part of it. So, the phone rang one day and I picked it up, and it was Ray Fisher of all people, Ray from the famous Fisher family. And she said, "Is that you, Sam?" I said, "Yes, Ray." She said, "Albert Finney wants a clog dancer." I said, "What are you talking about?" She said, "I'm telling you, Albert Finney wants a clog dancer, and I put your name forward." So I said, "Well, that's great." She said, "There'll be somebody ringing you up in a day or two." Well, you know, typical of show business, time went by and nothing happened. And then one day, about a fortnight later, Daphne said to me, "I'm finished. I said, "Yeah, you're pulling my slippy leg, aren't you?" She said, "No, it is. It's his manager." So, "Is that Sam Shelley?" "Yes." "Oh, we've been given your name. I believe you are a clog dancer, and you hold an equity card." So I said, yes. Yes, so he said, well, we're doing a play with Albert Finney at the Old Vic, and we would like you to come to London and see Mr. Finney. He's in America at the moment, but I'll phone him up and tell him about you. And perhaps you could come down to London, you know, to see him. So I said, that's fine. So the next week, he phoned me up and said, could you come down to you? I went down and Albert Finney, met Albert Finney. And then I found out that not only had Ray Fisher put my name forward, but that Madeline Hollis and Pat Tracy were going to do the club choreography for this show. And of course, they'd also put a word in for me. Mm-hmm. So with all of them going for me, you know, eventually I got the job. Also, I was asked if I could understudy Max Warley's part as the bargee in Sergeant Musgrave Dance, which I was, of course, delighted to do. I said, of course, I can do it, you know. So it was great. We did a 4 weeks rehearsal. All the cast went through dancing lessons every day with Madeline and Pat. Even Albert Finney. Not Willoughby Goddard. I don't know whether any of you know Willoughby Goddard, the big fat fellow that used to be Lamberger Gessler in William Tell. Well, he was excused in the dancing classes. But it was quite a great experience to be at the Old Vic at my time of life.
Come and I
wait
to see you.
Yes, we
went
and see
you. But why didn't you come and see me?
It was great. I didn't have time.
I'd have been delighted. So many.
I must say you put a good show up.
So many of my friends and also pupils came to see it. It cost me a fortune in seats because every time anybody came from the north, I thought, well, I can't ask them to pay for the seats. But it was wonderful. It was a great experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I shared the dressing room with Max Wall. At least I shared his dressing room. He didn't share mine. And we became great friends. And I'm only sorry that there wasn't a tape recorder going all the time that we talked about the old days, the acts we'd known, the pros we'd known, the people we'd known. It was really marvellous. For that alone, apart from doing my dance on the table in the pub scene and everybody waiting for me to fall off, which I never did. Teetered once or twice, but didn't actually fall off. So there we are. That brings me to June 1984. I started in 1927. So I reckon it's about 56 years, isn't it? It's a long time. 57. I thought, you couldn't add up. Oh, I see. So that's, you know, the story of me, musical, dancing. The story of how I came onto the folk world in the early 60s is perhaps another story which I might be able to tell to you at some future time. In the meantime, do you want to ask me anything? You don't. In clubs. Yes, well, of course, there were certain trades, even today, there are certain trades which still use clubs. Mainly, I think, in the brewery trade. The brewery trade, there's still a great place for using clubs.
I've seen one in Ford's.
Hmm?
Ford's factory.
Ford's.
Some departments
where clubs, yes.
Yes.
So there's still a great use for clubs. And, of course, they are coming back into fashion for a lot of students wear them because I suppose they... They're cheaper than shoes, and they wear longer. And yes, well, I mean, you can get a good pair of clogs about £20. I mean, if you get a pair of boots, working boots, about 40 or 50, I should think, these days. Not that I have to wear any working boots anymore, but... And I haven't bought a pair of clogs for a while. I'd get a shock when I next buy a pair, I suppose. I don't know whether I'll need any more, actually. I think I'm getting towards the end of the road when it comes to clog dancing. I missed more beats today than I care to think about. But then I'm out of practice. I haven't practiced, you know, in the summertime I don't teach. So that apart from the odd folk festival, I don't really do any practice. And even no matter how much experience you have, you never get past the need to practice. And so that, you know, it's far better to do a little practice several times a week than 2 hours every now and again. if you can do something every day, it's only 20 minutes, this is the way to progress. And this, if I did the same, if I practiced what I preached, I wouldn't have missed so many beats today. Right, so if you have no further questions, perhaps... Are you there, Barry? So if you'd like to put on the film. Now, it's not all dancing, and of course it's not all the dancing that we used to do. Because we used to do more acrobatics, but we hadn't in this little place. It was a converted garage where they used to do this filming in Shepherd's Bush, just down the side street in Shepherd's Bush. And the stage was so small that we didn't have room to do our proper acrobatics. And in the fiddle dance that you see, Peter and myself used to do a lot of the tricks in tandem, but in this you'll have to see we had to do them singly. So, but even so, I'm not making excuses. You'll have to just take it as you find it. Okay, roll it!
And now it's time to present those talented variety artists, the Five Sherry Brothers.
That's me there, look.
There are only four just now, but you can hear them.
Good looking, wasn't I?
And you'll see them in a moment.
It's peculiar seeing yourself 50 years back. I'm getting a bit used to it now, actually. But I'm the only one alive of the Five Sherry Brothers. All the other four brothers are dead, I'm afraid. I'm sorry to say. I still do have four sisters who are alive. All in the late 70s and 80s, and I was saying my other sister is 83 tomorrow. So we'll be rushing back tomorrow to go and have a drink for the parade. Well, I hope you've all enjoyed it. It's something I've never done before, so you know, you'll have to sort of excuse any faltering or anything else, but thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Been all right, but my wife's clapping.